It's incredible that I even can say this sentence. The president draws up a list of Americans to assassinate. You know, Al-Awlaki was an American citizen. He took out Al-Awlaki without charge or trial, and he took out his 16-year-old son without charge or trial. So this is 1984. I mean, it's here, it's happening, and so the issue is to wake people up, and I think people are a lot more alert, to realizing that there basically kind of has been a coup. It's just more visible in certain places, and there's still, like, what people don't understand is you can have a, you know, police state, essentially, and that's what I mean when I say a coup. Many aspects of America are now a police state, and other things seem to continue as normal. And so people kind of don't recognize that, oh my God, it's a police state, because it doesn't look like, you know, grainy newsreels of 1933 in Germany. People are still shopping, they still vote. You know, it's not like a blanket thing. But look at Ferguson in, you know, the way the militarization of the police forces, which is the definition of a police state, is that instead of domestic police who are answerable to mayors who are elected by the people, you have this Department of Homeland Security sending for profit vast, you know, tanks and
grenade launchers to schools. I mean, it's
snipers, you know, and it's like, this is what happens in a war zone or a police state. This is not the United States of America. So it is here. And so our strategy now has to be how to fight back.
Right. And even mainstream publications like the Boston Globe, I mean, they're basically documenting the existence of a shadow government here, Naomi. They're saying that the NSA,
really?
The intelligence community, the surveillance state, operates just self-governing. It does not matter what voters do, who they pick. These agencies will be self-governing until we actually do something drastic, I guess. I mean, it's just amazing to see them kind of outlining that. And I think you're right. I think it's this guise of a democracy where you know, there's this global blueprint all around the world, and people still think that we are free. And I guess that's the best slavery. That's the best tyranny, is when you think that you're free. I wanted to go on to, of course, you've come under a lot of heat for simply questioning things, but I wanted to talk about one of them in particular. One of the steps in the book, of course, is that internal surveillance, which you just outlined, you know, confirmed to Americans through documents leaked by whistleblower Edward Snowden. You were highly critical of the veracity of Snowden's story. I wanted you to go over what you found problematic and if you still felt that way today.
Yeah, I think that I'm more open to the possibility that he's a genuine whistleblower. But as with so many of these stories, my frustration is, and I was, you know, the center of some controversy a couple of weeks ago for simply saying, document it, investigate it. I mean, what's worrying to me is that we need the free press to ask questions, the kinds of questions they used to ask, independently verifying what the State Department says, what the White House says. And by and large, the press in America has stopped doing that. So there hasn't been much independent, you know, investigation of the Snowden story. There hasn't been much independent investigation or confirmation of, you know, the ISIS stories. A lot of stories that go to hyping people's fears or escalating our sense that we're always under threat, which is very lucrative for, you know, the war industry, there tends to be less and less independent verification. So what I do see is that the surveillance rollout is global, and that's why I worried that he was, actually, I said, this guy's trained as a spy before it was even known that he actually had been a spy. We knew he was a contractor. We didn't know he had actually been a spy. And you could tell that from the way he presented information. So I'm open to the possibility that he's an authentic whistleblower because of sources who are in that world who have said that that's more likely than I thought. But my worry remains the same, which is that there's a rollout which seems coordinated, and everyone's on the same page using the same sound bites in all of these democracies around the world, basically establishing that we're in a permanent 360-degree surveillance reality.
What about Brazil? You know, of course, Rousseff is now building that internet to avoid NSA surveillance, right, to Portugal.
That's so
there.
Cool.
And then, of course, James Clapper, I mean, perjured himself on the court when he said the NSA does not collect data on millions of Americans, which is a felony. Why would he do that if he was involved kind of in this backhanded rollout?
Why would he perjure himself?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, I think the truth is there is impunity now. It doesn't really matter if you lie to the American people anymore, which used to be an offense punishable by at least losing your position, if not prosecution. It doesn't really matter if you lie to the American people. I mean, I witnessed a spokesperson for the NSA speak to a room full of 400 journalists at an event The Guardian held and basically intimidate them and threaten them and say, you know, we'll go after journalists who do national security reporting. We'll prosecute you. I mean, it was chilling and frightening, and also lie to them about the nature of the surveillance that they've been doing. You see lies all the time, which is a hallmark of a closing society, when in a democracy there is such thing as truth because you have a free press that can verify and separate truth from lies. And in a closed society, citizens really don't know what's true anymore. Why would Clapper lie? I mean, I don't know the exact circumstances that you're describing, but I think that the messaging we're getting from the NSA is that basically the NSA is in charge and the Pentagon is in charge, and it really doesn't matter that much who's sitting in the White House. And in this respect, people really have to understand a police state doesn't happen like the Pentagon takes over or the military takes over and you don't have any civil society figureheads. In fake democracies around the world and police states around the world, the military is effectively in charge, and the, you know, secret police, which is basically the NSA, the surveillance apparatus, is basically in charge. But you still have a president and a Supreme Court and a press. I mean, I was just in Singapore, and they have elections and they have media, but everything's controlled by the government. So people really have to understand what's scary is that the power is draining from the window dressing. What's scary is that it really doesn't matter that much at this point who sits in the White House or who wins the election at a federal level if we don't get our rights back and put teeth back into driving these agencies back into the marginal support positions that they're supposed to hold in a real democracy.
Right. And yeah, I mean, as I was mentioning before, the Dilma Rousseff thing, it seems like there's this huge rift globally where, you know, as you said, kind of the Western powers are going lockstep along with the same type of legislation. Then you have all of Latin America, South America kind of standing up to the surveillance state. It's a really interesting rift, and I don't know where that's going to go, but it definitely seems like they're not on board. Let's move on to your project called Daily Clout. You're
Thank
talking
you.
About what we can do. You know, I mean, Boston Globe's already admitting that we live in this kind of, self-governing surveillance state, shadow government. What can we do locally? Because I feel like people are very disenfranchised.
People
obviously, the elections
totally
just prove that. Now, I mean, we have about a minute left. Talk about your project
sure.
and any advice that
sure.
you have.
Sure. So it's very exciting because it is a what can we do. It's a democracy-building community and web startup with technology that lets you embed search results for legislation right in a blog or news article and then send it flying through social media. And we're also doing citizen journalism on Facebook. Come look at it, us. You know, you can go to Naomi Wolf on Facebook, where the goal is to train everyone in the world to be a journalist so that there's no such thing as fog of war, so that people are accountable to what they're doing to the people. And we're breaking news stories continually. For instance, we had 500 people send in blank back ballots with, name, time, place. In the Scottish referendum, there was a lot of problems, to say the least, with the Scottish referendum. And so that's leading to investigations, judicial review,
Amazing.
And news media coverage. It's fantastic. So those are the institutions we need to put the grassroots back
everyone
in power, if not
check
in charge.
Check it out, dailyclout.com, DailyClout on Facebook. Thanks so much, Naomi Wolf, bestselling author. Amazing
thank
to have you on.
Now, thank you to The Real News Network for the next piece. This is from their series Reality Asserts Itself with Paul Jay, interviewing Chris Hedges on the pathology of the super rich.
The quote is, "The inability to grasp the pathology of our oligarchic rulers is one of our gravest faults." What are you talking about?
Because we don't understand the pathology of the rich. We've been saturated with cultural images and a kind of cultural deification of wealth and those who have wealth. You know, they present people of immense wealth as somehow leaders, oracles even. And we don't grasp internally what it is an oligarchic class is finally about or how venal and morally bankrupt they are. We need to recover the language of class warfare to grasp what is happening to us. And we need to shatter this self-delusion that somehow if, as Obama says, we work hard enough and study hard enough, we can be one of them. The fact is the people who created the economic mess that we're in were the best educated people in the country, Larry Summers, former president of Harvard, and others. The issue is not education, the issue is greed. And I, unfortunately, had the experience of being shipped off to a private boarding school at the age of 10 as a scholarship student and lived, I was one of 16 kids on scholarship, and I lived among the super rich and I watched them. And I think much of my hatred of authority and my repugnance for the ruling elite comes from having been among them for so long.
Yeah, people don't understand the elite schools, even at the high school level,
right.
that they get, the kids get excellent educations, they learn the whole culture of hundreds or thousands of years of how to rule.
Right.
And it's a deep, rich understanding of it.
Not only that, but they, you know, and George Bush is a perfect example of that.
Well, not so much an example of deep, rich understanding.
No, but of how, you know, affirmative action for the rich. And I came, certainly on my mother's side of the family, from, you know, lower working class. I mean, one of my uncles lived in a trailer in Maine, and certainly people with no means. And I would juxtapose the world I was in with that world. And it was very clear that it wasn't about intelligence or aptitude. The fact is, if you're poor, you only get one chance. If you're wealthy, like Bush, you get chance after chance after chance after chance. So you're a C student at Andover, and you go to Yale, and you go to Harvard Business School, and you're AWOL from your National Guard unit, and you're a cokehead, and it doesn't really matter. You don't even really have a job till you're 40 and you become president of the United States. So that was what was particularly insidious, how those small, tight, elite, oligarchic circles perpetuated themselves and promoted mediocrity, because many of these people, like Bush, are very mediocre human beings, at the expense of the rest of us, and how with money they gain the system. And of course, now we live in an oligarchic state where we've been rendered utterly powerless. And the judiciary, the legislative, the executive branches, all subservient to an oligarchic corporate elite. And the press is owned by an oligarchic corporate elite, which makes sure that any critique of them is never broadcast over the airwaves.
It's not some like inherent evilness or something, but you are brought up as a super rich or very rich in a culture, in a school, in a milieu where everyone's there to serve you. It's
right.
Your right to be served.
Yeah, it's very distasteful to see, because, you know, I would go to the homes of friends of mine and watch, and let's remember their children, 11, 12 years old, ordering around adults, their servants, their nannies. And I begin that piece by talking about Fitzgerald, who came from the Midwest to Princeton and went through much the experience that I went through. And that apocryphal exchange, which didn't take place, but it does represent the difference between Hemingway and Fitzgerald, where Fitzgerald at one point had written, but the story is that he said, the rich aren't like you and I, and Hemingway is supposed to have quipped, yes, they have more money. Well, Hemingway, like on many things, was wrong. The rich are different. Because when you have that much money, then human beings become disposable. Even friends and family become disposable and are replaced. And when the rich take absolute power, then the citizens become disposable, which is in essence what's happened. There is a very callous indifference. I mean, these people, and C. Wright Mills wrote about this in The Power Elite, they're utterly cut off. I mean, the only people they ever meet who are members of the working class are people who work for them. They're gardeners or they're chauffeurs. They live in self-encased bubbles. They have no real contact with reality. I mean, they don't even fly on commercial airlines. And yet they have absolute power. Now, that becomes very dangerous politically. Because they're so out of touch, and they are able to retreat into their enclaves in the same way that you saw in France under Louis XVI, people retreating into Versailles, or the end of the Chinese dynasty when everybody went to the Forbidden City.
He's Ephraim Le Deluge, is he not?
Yeah. They will extract more and more and more because they have no self-imposed limits without understanding the economic, political, and social consequences of what they're doing. So we have a popular uprising through the Occupy movement where people pour into public spaces to express legitimate grievances. Student debt, the next bubble to go down, $1 trillion in debt, which we now saw, courtesy of our Congress, debt rates will, you know, interest rates will actually go up in a couple of years. I mean, more than if they'd just taken it from a bank. It's insane. And meanwhile, the Federal Reserve is buying $85 billion a month worth of junk bonds and giving money at virtually 0% interest to Goldman Sachs. I mean, it's insane. The failure to address the mortgage and foreclosure crisis, the failure to address the chronic unemployment, underemployment, which, I mean, half of the country now lives in poverty, including the working poor. or near poverty. And what is the response? The response is to physically shut down the encampments, suspend unemployment benefits, cut food stamps, close things like Head Start. It's crazy. And that's what happens when you have an elite that is that unplugged, which our elite is. So they will push and push and push myopically out of ignorance until something erupts. And that's exactly where we're headed.
It's interesting. There are some children of some of the super rich, and I think Occupy had something to do with it, who kind of woken up a bit to the situation and don't want to repeat the pattern of their parents, get some of the insanity of it.
I don't know if they're children of the super rich. I think that Occupy had a lot of children of the middle class.
No, I don't mean the majority of Occupy.
Oh.
But I actually know who some of these people are.
Well.
And it's interesting that they're children of very, very wealthy people, and they have decided that, you know, there needs to be more to life than repeating this, living in this bubble.
Well, they may be out there, but I don't think they're a majority.
They're a very tiny minority.
Most of them get sucked right into that cult of the self, which the super rich managed to perpetuate at a rather nauseating level.
We were talking off camera just before we started how we both knew Gore Vidal. And Vidal used to go on about the total immorality of the super rich.
Oh, he would know.
Well, he would know for a lot of reasons. One, in terms of his own life, but also in terms of he knew many of these people.
Well, so did I. I mean, and I think that's what I'm getting at. Exactly. I mean, I wrote in that column about, you know, being at this boarding school and watching these fathers pull up in their limousines, fathers who had very little contact with their sons, with their personal photographers. And these were famous, wealthy men. And that picture of them playing with their son, which was a total fiction, would be disseminated through the press. Yeah, amorality, hedonism, selfishness, callousness. Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the total willingness to accept, for example, that ordinary people's families should send their kids off to war,
right,
to defend the American way of life, which means essentially their way of life,
right,
can die for these things. It's almost a kind of racism. I mean, when the British enslaved the Irish, you don't have to be black and of color to be thought of as less than human. And that seems to be what the super rich think about most other people.
Well, not just the working class. I mean, the kind of disdain for the working class and also the middle class. I mean, in some way, the way they would speak about the middle class, and, you know, in essence, coming out of the middle class, this was something that struck home to me. They inhabit another world, and they have very sophisticated mechanisms of public relations and well-publicized acts of philanthropy to hide their private faces. But how they act when the doors close and how they act in public is very different. And having, as Vidal was, as Fitzgerald was, you know, having been behind those closed doors and seeing the decadence of the ruling elite, it certainly marked me for the rest of my life. And it defined for me at a very early age who my enemies were.
You quote in your article Karl Marx writing, "The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships." Marx wrote, "The dominant material relationships grasped as ideas." Why did that hit you?
Well, because the whole notion of the free market, laissez-faire capitalism, globalization, is a very thin rationale for unmitigated greed by a tiny oligarchic elite. And they have made sure that ideology is taught in universities across the country. And people, especially economists who deviate from that ideology, have been pushed aside and become pariahs. And yet the driving ethos of that ideology is really to justify the hoarding of immense amounts of wealth by a very tiny percentage of, you know, the upper ruling class. That's what it is. The whole lie of globalization, perpetuated by people who popularize it, like Tom Friedman, has already been exposed. I mean, the idea that it's going to lift all of us up and create middle class and, you know, well-compensated working class families in the third world, I mean, all of it's been exposed.
And I think part of his point is that this isn't just some innate ideas that everyone is essentially greedy, these people just happen to be rich and you're not as lucky or as smart as they are. It's that it comes from what he calls the material conditions, about like how stuff is owned, who has power as a result of concentration of ownership, how things are distributed. It's not that it doesn't have to be this way. It's a product of how the society is organized.
Right. So in that sense, the ideology serves the system. the intellectual class serves the system. Those economists whose voices are heard, who get tenure, serve the system. And those who don't serve the system don't have a job. And that's what Marx was getting at. And I think that's extremely true. I mean, we don't live in a free market society. We live in a society where corporations at will loot the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve and are bailed out by the taxpayer. And yet that fact of kind of socialism for corporations is ignored. And that's dangerous because there's an utter disconnect from the language that we use to describe our economic system and the reality of our economic system, which is essentially a system where corporations have become predators on government and taxpayer money. And we're all going to pay for it because most of this stuff, these bonds that they're buying up, is garbage. Things like foreclosed homes that on the books are worth $600,000, but in reality, because the electricity has been turned off, the basement's flooded, you'd have to spend money to raise it to put up anything of any kind of value. And that is going to blow right up in our face.
And this idea that you're expressing that the majority of professional paid intellectuals, professors and writers and pundits, the idea that the free market is the fundamental assumption and starting point to suggest anything else might work is sacrilegious. And then some people say, well, that's because America's always been like this. America's the center-right country. But it's not true. And, you know, pre-World War II in the 1930s and right after World War II, there was a big public debate about what kind of economy, what kind of politics. And there was a real campaign waged to get rid of public intellectuals, get rid of union militants, get rid of actors and directors. Right. Anyone that wanted to have this public discourse was hounded out of office.
I write Death of the Liberal Class is really that story, how all of these people were silenced, pushed to the margins, stripped of employment, including like even high school teachers. I mean, Ellen Schrecker, the historian, has done a good job on this.
Just quickly for people to know what we're talking about. We're talking about the House of Un-American
right.
Activities, McCarthyism, and a real campaign to try to move anyone with a kind of progressive socialist idea out
right.
of anything. Where
and
they
were effective. I mean, in a way, far more effective than in Europe. I mean, in Europe, you'll still have a residue. Or we've been robbed of language by which we can express the reality of what we're undergoing. And that's because, you know, our radical populist dissident movements, those who offered a critique of the power elite, have been banished or silenced.
Now, you write something here which, you know, if you would not be allowed to say on mainstream news anywhere. You write, class struggle defines most of human history. Marx got this right. The sooner we realize that we're locked in a deadly warfare with our ruling corporate elite, the sooner we'll realize that these elites must be overthrown. There's a massive campaign not even to use the words class warfare. In fact, if you talk class, people accuse you of being essentially anti-American.
I don't think you can understand the nature of capitalism if you don't understand the nature of class warfare. If I was running a Wall Street firm, I'd only hire Marxian economists because they understand that capitalism is about exploitation. Marx got that right. And that gets back to the nature of the ruling elite. I mean, we are the most illusion society on the planet. The airwaves are awash in lies. You know, they very skillfully know how to humanize figures, I mean, even idiots like Donald Trump, to mask what it is they're actually doing to the rest of us. And I think we have to begin to puncture the very effective mirages that have been created. And corporations, of course, spend billions of dollars to create these mirages to understand our reality. I mean, look at BP. You'd think BP was Greenpeace, given the amount of commercials that they're running about how much they care about the Gulf, when in fact they turned the waters of the Gulf into a dead zone and poisoned the shrimp and all of the other which they're selling us to eat. And yet we don't have mechanisms by which, or they're certainly within the mainstream, what major network is going to go do a serious documentary on BP? You're not going to confront those interests because at this point, these interests, they own or control the systems of information as well as the systems of education.
Your article sort of ends with, the only route left to us, as Aristotle knew, is revolt.
Well, because the mechanisms of incremental and piecemeal reform don't work. And you talked about the New Deal. The New Deal was the classic example of that kind of safety valve. And as Roosevelt said. I mean, his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And in the stupidity of the corporate oligarchic elite, they destroyed the liberal class. I mean, we still have a self-identified liberal class, but they no longer do anything to defend the interests of those they claim to represent, whether that's the working class, the middle class, labor, or anyone else. And by destroying that safety valve, by destroying that liberal class, those mechanisms that made piecemeal and incremental reform possible, you no longer can adjust the system. So you can't ameliorate the suffering or the grievances of the underclass, and now we're talking about half the country. Now, that means that if you want to resist, if you want to create change, you can't do it through traditional political parties, you can't do it through the courts, you can't do it through a corporatized media. You have to step outside the system and create popular mechanisms, mass movements, that will begin to put pressure in a cruder way on the centers of power. That is the only hope we have left.
You say you can't do incremental reform. The elite can't even pass regulations that would serve their own interests in terms of controlling financial speculation, for example. A simple change in terms of position limits at the Commodities Future Trading Commission, that anyone that wants some kind of functioning capitalist system would want to have this so that you don't have another financial collapse as of 2008.
Right,
they can't even pass that.
Right, but they don't. The people who are running Wall Street don't give a damn about, they know it's going to collapse. And what they're doing is stealing as fast as much as they can on the way out the door. There's a very deep cynicism.
Well, they make money. They make money after the collapse as well, because they know the state's there to bail them out. So.
Right, but you know, this time around, it's going to be a little harder to pilfer state funds. I mean, they'll certainly attempt to do that. But you know, the goal is so self-centered. You have, I think the head of United Healthcare made $1 billion. I mean, it's insane. Last year, I think I have that right. But certainly hundreds of millions of dollars to people. And it's all about amassing little monuments to themselves, little empires to themselves. You know, I have relatives who work on Wall Street, and their critique is not any different from mine. The difference is they're just grabbing as much as they can on the way out the door. And I think that is always symptomatic of a kind of dying civilization.
Yeah, Marx was asked once to describe the psychology of a capitalist, and it was what we talked about a little earlier. Après moi, la déluge. After me come the floods.
Yeah,
I'll
sure.
get what I can today, and if the society is toast later, too bad.
And I think they know it's going to be toast. And I think they think that they're going to retreat into their gated compounds and survive it, and they may survive it longer than the rest of us, but in the end, climate change alone is going to get us.
So it's up to us. Don't expect anything from the oligarchs.
No. And not only that, they are creating systems in terms of exploitation not only of us but of the ecosystem that, if left unchecked, will ensure the extinction of the human species. It may already be too late, of course, but allowing the fossil fuel industry or these corporations to determine our relationship to the environment is a form of collective insanity at this point.
Thanks for joining us.
Now here's an audio adaptation of a video by Iran's Press TV, the first, I think the only, channel to be banned from cable in the UK. This is a video they made, The Strange Case of Philip Marshall.
Relatives and friends stunned by a violent crime in Calaveras County. Investigators say a father killed his two teenage sons before turning the gun on himself.
Investigators believe their own father, Philip Marshall, shot them, the family dog, then turned the gun on himself.
A shocking event that devastated a family and a community, leaving many questions to those who knew Philip Marshall. It's a tragic tale that gives rise to questions about what really happened.
Wayne Madsen, independent journalist.
Philip Marshall was an author, but he was also a commercial airline pilot. He flew contract missions for the Central Intelligence Agency, And this was in the early 80s, and he was involved in the what was called the Iran-Contra scandal. He, for example, flew one of the principals in that whole episode, a guy named Barry Seal. After Barry Seal lost his own license to fly, Phil Marshall would fly him on missions for the Drug Enforcement Administration and the Central Intelligence Agency. Barry Seal was assassinated in a gangland-style hit in 1986 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, right before he was going to testify about other people involved in Iran-Contra.
Kevin Barrett, author and talk radio host.
Philip Marshall was, he had retired, he was a retired airline pilot with this long CIA-related, crime-related history, and he was living in retirement in Calaveras County, California. Now, Philip Marshall has a very, very checkered history. He was smuggling cocaine with Barry Seal for the CIA. He piloted Barry Seal, the world's most notorious CIA drug smuggler, around in a private aircraft. And he was tied in with this group of, I think it's a group of 40, this CIA drug smuggling criminal network.
After he did the work for the CIA, where he flew to CIA bases in Central America, he went to work for Eastern Airlines, and then he went to fly for United Airlines. He retired in the 1990s.
Although Philip Marshall was a retired pilot, his interests in aviation and how the FAA conducts business remained intact.
Susan Lindauer, CIA whistleblower.
Philip Marshall was excited about his work. He was enthusiastic about it, passionate. And he had a lot to say and a lot to contribute. He had very strong family ties. He was a devoted father. Had a stable marriage.
His first book he wrote was called Lakefront Airport, and it was a novel based on his experiences flying people like Barry Seal around, flying in and out of Lakefront Airport, which he was very familiar with.
Difficult moment for America. Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
Wayne Manson.
After 9/11, he looked at that whole situation and he decided it could not have happened the way the government said it happened. And he wrote two nonfiction books. The last one called The Big Bamboozle, about how basically this scenario that was explained by the 9/11 Commission could have never taken place. That he, as a pilot, and he did fly the some of the planes that went into the World Trade Center. So he flew the 767, 757. So he was very familiar with these two aircraft, and he just looked at this as a pilot.
His time as a pilot and the author of two previous books raised speculation that Philip Marshall might have discovered new information on 9/11 that encouraged him to start writing a third book.
If you look at the first book, he maintained that the aircraft were piloted by the alleged hijackers, Mohammed Atta and the others. His third book, he may have been veering away from that theory, and the reason why is I attended Phil Marshall's memorial, and one of the things I found out from a family member was, my question was, can you tell me what he was looking at? What was the third book about? And the individual who told me actually works in government law enforcement, relative. And this individual told me, you want to look where my relative was looking. You want to look at the Marana. Actually, you want to look at Marana, Arizona. Marana, Arizona is the location of the Pinal Air Park. Pinal Air Park hosts Evergreen Aviation. Evergreen Aviation is a well-known CIA front activity. I think his books were like a series. As he would find out more and more information, obviously some people were reading his books, and he was being contacted by a lot of people who knew information. And every time he got more and more information, it seems like he would publish a new book. So he was working on yet a third book about 9/11. And we don't know what that book was going to be about. However, for one thing, his computer is still missing. The police confiscated his computer. And the last I heard, it was in the Department of Justice Technical Laboratory in Sacramento. He looked at this as a pilot and just, again, questioned how the planes could have been commandeered and how the military failed to respond according to their own regulations and operational orders. And so it was basically the big bamboozle was what the American people were told. They were lied to. The questions that Phil Marshall raised were, for example, how could the entire North American air defense structure and the Federal Aviation Administration manage to collapse in a period of, less than an hour, really, on 9/11, even less than that, less time than that. So he looked at that and said, how could this have happened unless there was some sort of collusion at the top? And, his questions were questions asked by many others, but very few people who asked those questions had the kind of background that Phil Marshall had.
Philip Marshall was in disbelief that the FAA would allow such a large miscommunication to happen on 9/11. He was trying to make sense of the events from an Air Force perspective. He was trying to figure out how the military and the FAA could falter on their own procedures.
Kevin Barrett.
Philip Marshall's version of 9/11 is a little different from mine. Philip Marshall's version is something along the lines of what we call a lie hop version, let it happen on purpose. That is, Philip Marshall accepts that there was a sort of radical Muslim Arab plot to attack the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, and that the role of the U.S. authorities was just to get out of the way and let it happen. That is, let it happen on purpose. And I, of course, am more with the MIHAP camp, the made it happen on purpose camp. That is, we believe that there was no such radical Arab Muslim plot, that to the extent that there was, that it was actually part of a national security false flag operation. I think that Marshall's version is perhaps a little easier to swallow for people who accept the standard picture of events in the media. It's hard for a lot of people to understand that their government is not really very democratic, that it's bought and paid for by these powerful financial forces behind the scenes, and that those financial forces are really what orchestrate these things. And it's hard for people to accept also, I think, that the millions of people killed in these wars after 9/11 have been killed for such a complete lie. Philip Marshall's book accepts the idea of these radical Muslim hijackers, ties them into the Saudi government, and then says that the U.S. government just got out of the way and let it happen. And no, I don't accept that.
Despite all the debate, many argue that 9/11 Commission released a solid report on the incident and it should not be contested. They write off other theories that deviate from this report as a conspiracy theory.
Phil Marshall, like many people who have written about 9/11, you either have to go to self-publishers or subsidized publishers or just-in-time publishers, because the big publishing houses, most of which are in New York, don't want to touch this story. They're more apt to publish books that substantiate and support the 9/11 Commission findings, maybe with a few disagreements, but not to suggest in any way, shape, or form that the government, the U.S. government, had any advanced knowledge of 9/11. That just doesn't usually make it through the process.
The mainstream world will not allow for any story besides the official story to be taken as the truth for 9/11. So how did those who dig too deep, trying to make sense of this tragic event, fit into society? The administration's attempt to help The way the media portrayed the official story of Philip Marshall's domestic murder suicide raised a lot of questions to those who are familiar with his work. As an investigative journalist, Wayne Madison looks into it.
Immediately when I got to Calaveras County, I actually walked around his house and looked in the windows. And this is probably about a week or so after his death, week and a half maybe. And first thing I noticed were a bunch of empty banker's boxes at his front door. The house had been basically cleaned out. The banker boxes were interesting because either they were left over from hauling some files out, or they were brought there and they said, well, we've got all our files, we'll leave these there. Or there were files in those boxes that had been removed. The computer had been ripped out of the wall, so the wires were still there, but it had been, you know, you could see where it had been yanked from the cable. He allegedly killed himself and his children the evening of January 31st. His children did not show up for school the next day, which was a Friday. It was a school day. Their friends got a little concerned because, you know, kids their age, they were teenagers after all. Saturday morning, and that was February the 2nd, the children came to the house. The door was open, unlocked. Phil Marshall had always told friends that with what he was writing, he had to be careful for personal safety. He always locked his door. The neighbor walked in, saw Phil Marshall lying on the floor on his back with a bullet hole which had bled profusely on the left side of his head. And this is very interesting because Phil Marshall was right-handed. The gun was lying underneath Phil's body. His son and his daughter were found shot on like a sofa, which was a U-shaped sofa, and they would one was on one long part of the U, and opposite on the other part was the other child. The pet dog, which is was a Shih Tzu, which was a little white yappy dog, was found dead, shot to death in the bedroom. Now, a lot of people wondered, even say you were going to kill yourself and your kids, you know, why the dog?
On the other hand, Sergeant Chris Hewitt commented on the police investigation, stating, all evidence and information at the scene confirmed that it was indeed a double murder-suicide, and there was no evidence to suggest that there was an outside party who entered the house and committed a triple murder. The Sheriff's Department made the same conclusion.
Kevin Barrett.
The question of whether Philip Marshall's death is a conspiracy theory or not is really kind of the wrong terminology. The real question is was this actually a murder-suicide, as the police say, or was it some kind of assassination, possibly a national security assassination? Given that background, and then given that Philip Marshall wrote a book arguing that 9/11 was a false flag operation, it certainly makes you wonder whether he may have been killed to try to cover something up, to prevent information that he had from coming to light, or something of that nature.
Susan Lindauer, CIA whistleblower.
The thing to understand is that in a murder-suicide, usually, in all cases, in a true murder-suicide, a husband is leaving his wife and wants to destroy the children and destroy any evidence of their marriage. Philip Marshall had a very strong marriage, and he had said to his friends, his private, very close friends, and also to some members of the 9/11 community, that he was worried that his family would be targeted by government agents and might face repercussions for his own activism and his outspoken opposition in challenging the official story on 9/11. So he had spoken about his fear for his family at this time. Usually in a murder-suicide where the dog is also killed, it's because there's a single parent who feels the children and family pet will have no one to care for them after the adult is gone. So they kill the entire family in despair. There is nothing about Philip Marshall as a man that fits the profile of a murder-suicide. This is not something that anyone believes who knows him.
This brings about speculation on Philip Marshall's case possibly being an FBI cover-up. Was he in the midst of researching information that could have embarrassed the U.S. government or discovered something the federal government didn't want exposed? Philip Marshall raised concerns to his family members that he might be a target because of his work. Would his sudden death raise questions to his family members?
So a relative of Phil Marshall who works in federal law enforcement said, look, Phil was snooping around Marana, and I checked it out, and it's the location of Evergreen Aviation, which is a CIA proprietary airline. It has been a location for a lot of CIA operations, aviation operations, and it still is. And Special Forces, U.S. Special Forces, train there. They do paratroop training and other special operations there. But Marana may not be familiar to many people, but anyone who's driven by Marana eventually can look out over a field, a huge airfield. However, when I realize what Marana is, there can be only one explanation why Phil Marshall was interested in Marana. And that reason is that, this was the subject of his next book, it would have been a blockbuster. It could have explained all the anomalies about 9/11, that the planes that hit the Trade Center were actually recommissioned civilian aircraft, 757s, 767s, from the Marana airfield, where they are stored. The only explanation is that Phil Marshall was tipped off by somebody on the inside. He had been contacted by some old veterans of the Iran-Contra affairs, Central Intelligence Agency people. So the next book and what the government would have killed him for is that Phil Marshall had obtained some information that the aircraft used on 9/11 were not those regularly scheduled commercial planes, American and United.
People who doubt the official story of 9/11 suggest that Philip Marshall was murdered because of his 9/11 related novels. They believe Marshall was exposing certain information that was kept secret from the public.
I don't know whether Marshall was murdered. You know, I'm not even 100% certain that he was murdered at all. I mean, it's possible the police version could conceivably be true. Wayne Madsen, who I trust, says that he's 100% sure that the police version is wrong. But I haven't studied it enough to really know. But as far as likely motives for this being a professional hit, which is what I think it probably was, would include a lot of things other than 9/11. I don't think he was murdered just because he wrote a book on 9/11. A lot of us have written books on 9/11. There are many, many dozens. There are probably actually well over 100 pretty solid books discussing various aspects of the 9/11 inside job by now. And nobody has been running around murdering authors of 9/11 books. So no, I don't think that was the reason. It's more likely that he had some kind of information that someone didn't want made public. His computer apparently was taken after he was killed, and there were people cleaning his house. There were mysterious vans showing up with communications equipment doing unauthorized cleanings of his house, according to Wayne Madsen. So it sounds like somebody was after information that he had, and that could have involved anything. So he probably had some kind of information, and they probably killed him and took the information back.
I believe that Philip Marshall was killed by a private security firm. There is another death, very suspicious death, of Michael Hastings, who was a Rolling Stones journalist who wrote a devastating article on General McChrystal, who was running the battlefield front in Afghanistan, who was then fired. And Michael Hastings then turned his attention to General Petraeus and the use of surveillance on top leaders in the United States for purpose of blackmail. Michael Hastings was killed in the same community as in the greater Los Angeles area as Philip Marshall.
Did Philip Marshall go too far in his research of national security issues? If so, could there be similar cases out there?
Phil Marshall is not the only person who has had an interest in U.S. covert operations, 9/11, who has died suspiciously. He's one of many, unfortunately. And in every single one of these cases, proper police investigation techniques are overlooked. There's inadequate forensics. Why was the crime scene cleaned before the investigation was complete? What happened to Phil Marshall's computer? Who has it now? What information was on it? Who were the people who went to the premises after the professional cleaner showed up in the unmarked SUVs? What agencies did they represent? Were there federal government agents present? What is going on at Marana Airfield? What did Phil Marshall stumble across at Marana Airfield at Pinal Air Park that could have gotten him have a death sentence put on his head? Why the kids? These are things that anybody would ask.
Could 9/11 whistleblowers' lives be in danger?
The authorities in this country do not run around just killing anybody who does 9/11 truth work. They have other ways of dealing with us. They do character assassinations. They assassinate our reputations and keep us from making a living. They marginalize us. They have all kinds of strategies for harassing us. But thank goodness they, for the most part, don't kill us. So unless somebody hands me an envelope full of information that somebody really doesn't want me to put out, and that hasn't happened yet, I don't think that I'm likely to meet that fate. At least I hope not.
Well, I will tell you that, as you know, I was the second woman arrested on the Patriot Act, the second non-Arab American woman arrested on the Patriot Act. And there is a misconception in the United States that only foreigners are being targeted, and certainly mostly they are. However, what's happening increasingly is, especially with private security firms, are tasked to police the community with no judicial supervision at all. And they are taking it upon themselves to punish, to hand out punishments which are outside the policy barriers.
I think we need to pursue this case and pursue the truth in all cases like it, where it appears that somebody who had become a whistleblower, which Philip Marshall apparently had become towards the end of his life, is killed, and especially when family members are killed too. This is a bad enough crime that I think that we need to get at the truth. We owe the truth to Philip Marshall, to his family, and to the country. And even if it were to turn out that it wasn't the federal authorities behind this, we need to know that. You know, it's just not right to be living in a country where the truth about these kinds of situations is just not available. If we don't have the truth, we can't have an informed populace, and we can't have anything remotely resembling democracy. So yeah, this is one of those cases where we need to tenaciously continue to pursue the truth.
We may never know what really happened to Philip Marshall and his family that day. Many believe the Sheriff Department's conclusion, but others are convinced a third party is responsible. In this story of a young and happy family's shattered tragedy, Philip Marshall's case leaves more questions than answers. Similar to the mysterious deaths of fellow authors J.H. Hatfield, Gary Webb, and Hunter S. Thompson.
And to conclude, let's hear a little bit more from Heidi Boghossian.
A quotation from Committee Chair Frank Church of the Church Committee that was formed after revelations of COINTELPRO were brought forward by citizens who broke into the FBI local office in Media, Pennsylvania. And at that time, outrage publicly was so enormous that the programs were quickly stopped. Although J. Edgar Hoover did say that he considered them a success and there was great possibility they could be reopened in the future. But Church, who was a Democrat from Idaho, said that every presidential administration in the past, be it Republican or Democrat, had abused their power. And he said, quote, the NSA's capability at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. If any dictator ever took over, the NSA would enable it to impose total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back. And I don't think it's true there's no way to fight back. We have choices we can make as consumers. And quite honestly, consumerism has brought us to a large degree to where we are right now. But I think that we've seen such failures of government officials who have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution to really do their job that it's worth reminding us that as we the people, we are an important part of holding the government in check and making them do their job. So I think opt-out is one possibility.
Opt-in.
And what you said about the businesses who say they have no choice, well, they do have a choice. And I know they're pressured so much by government to have what they call a back door where law enforcement can gain access to our information even more easily than they do now. But I think if we go back to the days of the Church Committee, what they did was put in protections, the Attorney General guidelines, as they're called. And Attorney General Levi said that the FBI can't spy on political dissidents and, you know, politically active individuals based on their religious or other ideologies. They have to have probable cause that some criminal activity is underway. And over the decades that have passed since then, those protections have been eroded, both federal protections and the ones that state local municipalities have in place. Now, after the USA Patriot Act, we've seen consent decrees that have been put in place in police departments across the country fizzle away. And now an agent only really has to say that they, in good faith, believe that an investigation should be opened. An example that we just found out a couple of weeks ago, purely by accident, by activists in Washington State, where there's an important lawsuit going on involving the Army spying on peace groups, but actually destroying the peace groups. The local police worked with La Fusion Center, followed these activists, gave them, you know, really multiple arrests for non-existent charges. One person was kicked out of his apartment. Others suffered emotional damage, and the peace groups were destroyed. But one of the activists filed Freedom of Information Act requests and found out about Project Hemisphere, which the New York Times reported on 3 or 4 weeks ago, where this government is actually paying AT&T staff to sit side by side with drug enforcement agencies and to have access to AT&T phone records going back 26 years. And I'm saying this because I think when we have data that is stored, as you said, and building a new data center in Utah, which can house more computers so that they can process more data, we're really seeing an international race for which government can accumulate the most data. And clearly the U.S. wants to be at that top of the list. Hand in hand with that goes an enormous amount of secrecy about these programs, so that it's often just by accident that we learn really the extent to which our personal records are being gathered, stored, and then with storage, really at risk of not only inaccurate data, but getting in the hands of people who may want to alter your medical or financial or other records. So there's a lot of possibility for manipulation.
But that won't be my end for my guns and my saddle.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Willie Guthrie. The show is made possible by listeners such as yourself contributing suggestions of suitable material.